Thank you for such an insightful presentation. I'd want to open it up to questions. And so for those of you in the room, if you'd wait for me to get you the microphone, see your name and organizations. We're really curious who's in the room. And then I actually want to turn it over to our webinar audience. Well, if there's anyone in the room who has a question, let me raise your hand and I'll pass you the mic.
Hi, my name is Sharon Zarnick, and I'm with USADF, African Development Foundation. We work primarily, we work in Africa, and every time I come to these, I hear the examples of Kenya, Cote d'Ivoire, Senegal, South Africa, but where we work is in the other countries that no one ever talks about, in Niger, Mauritania, Zambia, Burundis of the world. I was really interested to hear more about the example in Peru and about how to build out the infrastructure. For example, in Burkina right now, I have sesame producers, and it's a big export product. They just had a wonderful year a couple years ago. But we have the same problem, whether it's men or women, about them getting attacked when they get their payments from a union that provides their payments for them. And the mobile money just isn't there. So learning more about building out the infrastructure so that there is access, I would love to hear more about that.
Happy to talk about that. I'll give the example of Peru because that's one of our members and that's what I know best. Peru's financial inclusion numbers are that 71% are excluded, 29% are included. So and yet it's quite a strong economy. And so they said, look, we don't want to be in this position. We want to address financial inclusion. And so the government started its financial inclusion strategy. At the same time, the Bankers Association realized that there was a potential economic opportunity, but they could never all make money by reaching beyond the main urban Lima and the main urban centers. They started talking about whether it would be possible to collaborate on the infrastructure and then compete on the product, because the numbers just simply didn't work. So the Bankers Association started discussions with the financial service providers, the payment service providers, and then at the same time, the regulator was advancing e-money regulation, and at the same time, the government was working on its financial inclusion. So there was a very strong alignment between the government and the private sector and the regulator in terms of addressing financial inclusion. And so what the Bankers Association did was they set up a separate company called PDP, Pagos Digitales Peruanos, and they were that was going to build out the infrastructure. And all the banks contributed to that, to the initial capital for that company. They put out an RFP, hired a company to build out the mobile infrastructure to reach across Peru. They have very reasonable expectations. Their break even was not going to be reaching everybody. Their break even was in 3 years to reach the peri-urban and urban, so that they knew that they could make money, because this was essentially a private sector initiative. Banco La Nación was the government bank that was involved in the Bankers Association as well, so it had full support from the government. So they then had the build out, and then they're launching a mobile wallet called BIM. And it's been operating all, but the official, so they know that it's all working well and the official launch is very shortly. But what has then happened is that they will then, basically you don't have to register. If you've got a phone, then you have an account. So if you send money to your grandmother up country, she can get it immediately onto her phone. She doesn't have to go and register and do all sorts of other complicated things. It's immediately on her phone, and she just has to choose which financial service provider she wants to be able to have her account at. That's the only choice she has to make on the menu. And so this means that there is a common infrastructure that everyone is using, so their costs are way down. I can give you all the numbers if you're interested, but their costs are very limited for the infrastructure. And then they can use that. Anyone can use that. It's a shared platform. It is completely interoperable between all the banks, and they've figured out the pricing structure. And it is able to then provide access for anyone. So it's been happening, but the official launch is about to happen, and there will be, so there's tremendous excitement about that, because that has the biggest opportunity for inclusion. So in a country, in the countries that you're working in sub-Saharan Africa, this kind of thing, we do not recommend it be replicated. Please, we're not saying that. We're saying that this is the kind of partnership that can be, that can, we can learn from, so that in each market, as appropriate, there are opportunities for collaboration on the infrastructure and then competition on the product.
Thank you for that case study. Let's turn it over to our webinar.
Like, I have a question on this theme of illiteracy and like women who don't probably won't have access to mobile networks. Faustina is asking, like, I wonder how these can work in Ghana, considering high rate of illiteracy among subsistence farmers who are mostly women. And I think there's a similar question by Gabriel as well, who says, what about use of mobile in the portion of women which are illiterate? So this is on that theme. And there's another one which was on the cultural theme, which I thought was interesting. Kathleen Tobin from Chittagong asks, I would like to hear Leora and Ruth's thoughts on strategies to overcome cultural barriers, such as the one Leora mentioned in Bangladesh, where women are not allowed to have phones, which can mean that a mobile salary payment would bypass her completely and go directly to her husband.
So illiteracy, you know, there are simple solutions. You know, we've seen really, in India, for example, there are graphical-based, picture-based ATM machines, which have become very popular. South Africa also has graphics. So rather than force a woman to read, that she could actually press the appropriate picture, which sounds very simple, but it has made a tremendous difference. There's also certainly biometrics is being used. Again, you know, not to trivialize this PIN number issue. I mean, it sounds trivial to us, but remembering the PIN, typing in the correct order, and also just the, you know, the woman unable to manage the recourse process to get a replacement number is tremendous. And so moving to biometric thumbprints, for example, on both ATM machines and phones, and with mobile agents, has also great potential. And that's also rapidly growing, especially in India. My colleagues have done some very interesting work in Malawi, for example, also with biometrics. With Ghana, once you, these are the challenges of expanding among the illiterate community. You asked me in Ghana. So, for example, in the marketplace, we've been working with. So, in Ghana, the interesting case there is the move from the use of these very expensive susu collectors. Can we provide a formal? And also, the susu collectors, you usually get your money back, but they still are unsafe. You know, a woman was saying to us, you know, in another country, how she joins five Raskas because the first four are going to steal her money. And there are advantages, again, of being in the formal system to build your payment history to receive appropriate credit, et cetera. So we actually piloted a, you know, bank susu in the marketplace where we had a guy in a moped from the bank going around offering collection services in this large market in northern Ghana. And to our surprise, it was huge take-up, people giving lots of money, but they never withdrew it. And so this is going on and on. And, you know, suddenly after a couple of months, the amounts are getting bigger and bigger, then they withdraw the full amount. We asked them what was going on, and they were saying, well, for day-to-day cash management, I have my system, but I need to buy, you know, a generator or a refrigerator, and I need the cash collateral. And for that, it's this long-term savings goals, especially for business owners, that they can't reach under the mattress, that the money in the pocket, you know, it's very hard to save long for larger amounts for long-term, that having a bank account and having access to formal services is tremendous. And so, again, these were not, you know, especially necessarily educated, formally educated market vendors. However, they understood the need to keep their money outside their home, with, you know, beyond temptation to reach that longer-term business goal, savings goal.
On the issue of overcoming a range of norms that are against women's economic participation, obviously, the blindingly obvious statement is that it depends on the context. But for our colleagues at Women's World Banking, who work in many markets where women are more excluded, the part of their experience is that not seeing it as necessarily a challenge to be overcome, but as a context to work with. And so who are all the stakeholders in this? Everyone wants to have a better life for their family. Everybody wants to have their children well-fed and well-educated. And so focusing on the shared goals, on the shared opportunities, and so therefore figuring out within that particular cultural and economic context ways to ensure that those good things happen. Everyone wants to be able to reach their grandmother with money if she needs some help if she's upcountry. Everybody wants to be able to ensure that their family are taken care of. And so working within the cultural context to be able to focus on the opportunities that everybody wants and to then figure out how to achieve that our colleagues have found that to be the most effective. And then working within the parameters that women have. And in the report, it talks about Kashif and Pakistan, where they have seen that it helps women manage their multiple responsibilities if they have the phone and can transact at home rather than elsewhere. And so they've done some great, I encourage you to read the report for examples like that, to be able to say, look, there are ways where it can work within the cultural context to support women's economic participation to achieve everybody's goals.
Yeah, I mean, this is something really important. A phone is no longer, you know, something to make phone calls with. I mean, it's becoming a human right to have your own phone. It's increasingly, you know, key to receiving all sorts of government services, from health information to registering your children for school. And it's not enough. So it's interesting, you know, colleagues were recently mentioning a number of the percentage of households that have a mobile phone. And that's not the phone that hangs on the wall. You know, ownership of your own phone is becoming critical. You cannot receive a government transfer payment or wage payment to a phone registered in somebody else's name. The privacy over, you know, again, your medical records are, having your own phone gives you tremendous privacy, confidentiality, and control not only over your finances, but over, you know, increasingly a wide range of aspects of your life.
Hi, my name is Marissa Germain, and I work with IESC. And thank you so much for this wonderful presentation. My question was about the informal businesses and the fears that they have of going digital. What are some of those fears, and what are some things that are being done to address those?
Taxes is a simple answer, three-letter answer. These are firms that may not be paying formal taxes or be formally registered, and it's simply a fear that there's now an electronic paper trail of their sales and purchases that could be shared with other authorities.
I do want to draw your attention to the woman in the picture there. She is a business person in Mexico, and it comes from one of our members, Grupo Bimbo, that's working. It's a large retailer, and they have lots of small mom-and-pop stores, and this is one of them. And they are working with women, I can't remember her name, but like her, who are then just helping them understand the technology and then seeing how it will benefit them. So it's really saying, look, there are lots of benefits for you. You can track your financial transactions much better. You can manage it much better. You can manage your cash flow. You can see exactly what's happening. So they have been helping women understand and do better financial management through the digitization of their transactions. So therefore, the benefits that are seen and realized and are much bigger than the fears of what may happen next. And some governments are realizing that formalization is a very important goal for them, that having people excluded is a real problem for a range of different reasons, and of course for growth and poverty reduction and women's inclusion. And so are thinking about how to communicate to reduce the fears of this kind of oversight or over taxation. And so understanding that there are much greater benefits from the digitization has been a key part of the work that's been happening where it's successful.
There have been some interesting private sector initiatives, for example, to give these one register firms, you know, handheld scanners. And in exchange for scanning all their purchasing and sales, which this private sector firm would be then selling to the Unilevers of the world, they were offering the firms detailed reports on their sales history. So how many cans of Coke you sell on Wednesday versus Tuesday, which I thought would be valuable to the firm. It wasn't enough. a large survey in a large Asian country, 70% of these one registered firms said they keep their books in their head. They won't even write down their sales history. So what's the incentive? The incentive is reduced costs because they're using supplier credit. You know, if once you digitize, you can repay on Monday some of that credit, not wait, you know, perhaps for at a better rate than if you repaid only once a week. And then, of course, there's the once this payment history is electronic, to use that to provide appropriate formal credit, because most of these small firms don't have any formal credit, and they may want to invest in their businesses or elsewhere. But it's hard.
Yeah. Yes, so we'll go back to the webinar again. I have a couple of questions. Alfred from Johannesburg is asking, is the success of facilitated saving groups not sufficient evidence of how informal saving mechanisms do, in fact, also offer positive returns? Even when focusing on financial returns only. If this is positive, does this also not open scope to think more innovatively how digital financial service can add value to such proven informal mechanisms? And another one by Ekanath from Nepal. He's asking, my general question here is how to make more affordable technology in designing the local content as per the local market system so that low-income families and women could afford to buy.
So the informal question, if I understand correctly, Usman, is they're asking whether there can be lessons learned from the informal savings group that can be applied in the digital products. Is that correct?
Yep.
And so the answer is yes. Of course, there's a reason that women are choosing these groups because it meets their needs. Although there, as Leora just said, there are significant trade-offs in that. And so the low denomination, high frequency, and value of savings are a really important part of the product. But understanding what women's aspirations are and why they're using different products is, it sounds blindingly obvious, but it's something that people often forget, that unless it's actually designed for women, it's not going to serve their needs. And so there's figuring out what the particular aspects of the product does, not what somebody else thinks the aspects of the products are important, but what the women who are actually working in those groups thinks the benefit of it is really important. But also the social interaction part of it, it's not just isolated. There's some recent research out of, Kenya, but because there's lots of research going on, which talks about the very close connection between the social value that's gained from the groups as well as the financial value. And so understanding that social interaction as part of the product is another important aspect to remember.
And there are examples of banks mimicking the social aspects of the group. Can they also provide education, not only financial education, education often on disperse information on healthcare, et cetera. However, keeping the money within the bank, and again, as technology evolves and sophistication of credit models is rapidly evolving, that savings/repayment, borrowing repayment information is very valuable for women later on if they need an appropriate credit. So there is the value of formalizing in some way these informal saving groups. So these are women able and willing to save, so there should be a benefit of the saving behavior towards future financial goals.
Hi, my name is Rachel Fredman with U.S. Treasury. Thanks so much for this really interesting presentation. I just wondered, Leora, I believe you touched on this a little bit, but this question of privacy and confidentiality, I wondered if you could discuss that a bit more in the context of technology and sort of and what we're seeing from the evidence in terms of the differences in how men and women value those things and what kinds of tools can be utilized to further women's financial inclusion.
Hi, Thomas Gibb from USAID. Building on that thought and pulling back to the example of Peru, with data privacy, do you have any examples of a collaborative approach between government and digital financial service providers on defining digital data privacy and being able to clarify some of those the limits?
This is Nazir Ahmed with GivingWorks. It seems related to that is really the security issue as well. You know, we all know about Target and the credit cards be getting hacked. You had Malawi with a $32 million at least disappearing through Cashgate by just manipulation of payment systems and software. And you're talking about a group of people where we have had a system of petty thievery and petty leakages. And one of the things I think I would ask about from a risk management point of view, it's what's being done and needs to be done to make sure that as you start aggregating this micro savings and micro payments, they become soon lots of big money. And what's being done to protect those, particularly with people who don't often have the paper trail, if you will, literally the hard paper trail, if you go to this system.
I mean, so we could, there could be an entire session on privacy, on that side, which, again, you're right, we didn't get into much, but, you know, other than the, clearly the government needs an appropriate, and that would fall into the consumer protection framework, to ensure data privacy and security. And in terms of sequencing, you know, certainly it's encouraged that that comes before the growth in the market. In terms of the privacy and confidentiality there, I can talk to you some more. There's growing evidence that women value that aspect. An early study actually just gave women a box with a lock and showed that that, you know, had a huge significant increase on savings. Just this idea that she was able to save somewhere that people, A, didn't have access to it, but also didn't know how much she was saving. The importance of, so for example, in Bangladesh, go back to that example where we've been running this study, we've been speaking to the woman. This woman said to us, you know, my mother-in-law waited outside the gate for me on payday, now she can't. And it's this ability to keep your money, have greater control of your money. So there's another study showing that, you know, women speak with their husband at more opportune times how the money should be spent, if the money is put into digital form as opposed to coming home with cash in her pocket. You know, other women saying how my husband knows my base salary but didn't keep track of my overtime so I could save more money towards a future goal. And just allowing, you know, and certainly there are also issues you want in terms of household optimization of expenditure, but giving the woman the digital payment allows her greater control over how the money's spent and or saved.
On the issue of security and risk management, again, of course, the consumer protection is vitally important in each market, and there's a lot of good work being done by the bank and others on this. There is also good work being done by the Responsible Finance Forum that is working with providers and new payment service providers on principles that will help good practice in responsible delivery of so the delivery of payment services. So there's the formal legal as well as the principles for the new players who are working in this area. So there's a lot of work moving in this space. Of course, the if you're going to be issuing an RFP for digital services, you want to build into that a requirement for appropriate security, appropriate confidentiality of the data, compliant with the laws of the country. And so it's one of the things that those of us who are working on this need to take into account. But also, that one needs to also think of the counterfactual. You know, for those of us who work in the Better Than Cash Alliance, we hear, you know, can't tell you the number of problems. And the Malawi case that you brought up, the Cashgate, was because it was not digital. It was checks that were being cashed. And so there was lots of cash under people's beds. And it was, there's a lot of stories about that, that won't go on the record here. But in terms of the challenges in that market, so it wasn't the digital problem. It was the manual problem in that particular case. So being aware, for those of us who are working in this sector, being aware and building it in into the way that we work with our partners is critical, because we can't afterwards... it's much harder to fix than beforehand. So it's really important to be aware of that and build it into the design and the technology when it starts.
I'm Joseph from International Medical Corp. I'm curious to know whether you have examples of this in emergency context or as part of emergency response.
Incredible. In the report, it mentions the Ebola response, and I think Sierra Leone was is a poster child for how mobile financial services were used in payments to Ebola response workers. Those of you who don't know that example, it was, as you know, cash is a big problem. If you're going to be transporting it, it's expensive. But if you're transporting it in a health crisis, it's a death knell for some people. So it's even more of a problem. So you've got to figure out how to digitize those payments. And they realized in that context that there were mobile phones and they could use them as mobile wallets, but everyone had to be registered who was an Ebola response worker. And so I think the data was in 3 days, they got 15,000 people registered. It was an amazing, it took the government and the army and the humanitarian effort and the United Nations and, you know, to all say, this is a massive problem, we need to fix it now, because unless we can pay Ebola response workers, we are not able to fulfill our moral obligation to those people who are putting their life on the line. So it was an amazing collaboration to be able to address that. So that's probably there's some case studies on that, and we're actually one, there's a more detailed one about to come out. The Sierra Leone's a member of the Better Than Cash Alliance, and at the General Assembly in September last year, the Minister of Finance of Sierra Leone spoke incredibly impassionately, like, this is a basic infrastructure for us to be able to pay people for emergencies. It showed us how important this is. If we don't have this, when the humanitarian crisis happens, we won't be able to solve our problems. And so that has generated a whole lot more discussion. At the World Humanitarian Summit coming up in May, those of you who work in emergency humanitarian know that that's a big event, and USAID is working well towards that, is saying, let's look at principles of digital payment in humanitarian context, because this is such an important tool for us in our humanitarian response. So that's it's a very exciting time to be involved in this work.
Hello, yes. I have a question from Derek, who's logging in from Mexico. He has a two-part question. The first part is, he wanted to know about these two things, the onerous AML-CFT regulations that limit the utility of digital payments. How, like, can you tackle those? And low-income people tend to change phones and SIM cards constantly. How do we make sure they maintain access to online accounts, even as they constantly switch devices and service providers?
So I guess to address the first point, and we didn't use that term. For women especially who lack financial identification, financial identification is necessary to open a bank account or any sort of account to discourage, prevent terrorist financing and other money laundering and other illegal activity. And so for women who don't have any identification, it's often a barrier to opening an account. Some countries have relaxed for small accounts, which have strict limits on the amount of money that can be kept in the account and the amount of transactions per month, et cetera, what I call relaxed or tiered know your customer. So as I gave the one example is employer records is one example of tiered KYC. I believe there are other examples that waive the formal government-issued identification, et cetera. But so that's the issue surrounding know your customer. Regarding
changing phones and SIM cards.
Yes, this is a huge problem. So it gets even more complicated. So when we went to Bangladesh, we thought, well, it's hard to open a bank account, but mobile accounts are easy. That was not the case. And this is just an example, and I'm not criticizing a specific country, it's more general challenges in this market. To open a bank account, we used employer records under their example of tiered KYC. However, to open a mobile money account in your own name, you need a registered SIMS card. And so even the people who had phones, it seems that most people in the country buy their SIMS card in a gray market, because to get a SIMS card has very strict identification requirements, which many people didn't have. So it's definitely a challenge. And if you have an account, and this is around the world, if you use a mobile money account on a phone without a SIM card being registered in your name, in general, you would lose your balance. And people know this, and they've heard of people who have lost their money, which makes them very fearful of using the mobile money product. And so this is just something that needs to be, people need to be aware of and needs to be addressed, that the challenges only it's not only a financial challenge, a problem of financial regulators. It's also very much a challenge of those who regulate the SIMS card market as well in order to expand mobile account ownership.
Yes, couldn't agree more on the regulator on the telco side as well as on the financial service side. And recognizing that that's a challenge is a really important first step to then working with those, because often those who regulate don't realize what a problem it is for those who are excluded, for low income, for women and others. And so helping regulators understand that what they're doing. And so it's really important to have, whether it's a regulatory impact statement or be involved in the discussions before or as they happen, so that people realize that, so that the regulators, whether it's telcos or others, understand the implications for women. On the AML CFT, there is going to be a white paper coming out from the G20 standard setting bodies subgroup of the Global Partnership for Financial Inclusion that will be looking at some of these issues in terms of inclusion. So I think there is a consultative paper out on the GPFI site. Is Loretta's nodding? So yes, it is. And that is looking at how AML CFT can be used to support inclusion through a tiered approach. But one thing that you need to know, whoever you are, the initials ISIP, ISIP, because from a standard setting body, from an AML CFT body, that means all four important. It means financial integrity, financial stability, financial inclusion, and financial consumer protection, ISIP, ISIP. And so those are all important. And so understanding that they're mutually beneficial is really for any particular market, so that inclusion and integrity and protection and stability are mutually reinforcing is a key part of not taking one part out of context, but understanding that they're all important.
Yeah, absolutely. And just you mentioned the multiple SIMS card swapping, that's usually driven by the lack of interoperability, which we discussed earlier. So if the mobile companies aren't interoperable, you can't send money from one provider to another, you need to swap in and out different SIMS cards with different wallets depending on who you're sending or receiving money from, which is clearly less efficient.
Thank you. My name is Sarah Benavent from Ayani, an inclusive financial consultancy firm. And my question is kind of wrapping up several of the challenges that we've been mentioning around SIM cards and the access to smartphones, the access to internet as well in rural areas. And I'm wondering whether there have been some efforts towards digitizing the traditional SUSU groups. We mentioned this a little bit before, but the answer was more towards banking systems. Given that in rural areas, mostly in Africa, they're used to using the SUSU groups, they trust them, and it's been proved to work. Has there been some efforts towards centralizing the access to digital financial services? Let's say that this group of women can access their digital accounts and their mobile accounts through a single person who has access to this registered SIM and telephone and internet access. That's
The short answer is, absolutely yes. There are a number of research projects, of leading academics working on that. I think of many African countries where there. So there's two challenges. One is the regulation has to allow for bank agents, which. And even today, many countries don't allow that, so that somebody is allowed to collect and disperse money on behalf of the bank, and that allows an agent of the bank to go out to the rural areas on behalf of the bank, which is a regulatory requirement. And second of all, a second challenge is really the commercial viability. This is a relatively poorer, often market segment, saving, as I said, it's a few dollars frequently, which are... neither of which are necessarily profitable to the bank, right? So it's high transaction costs, very low float. And so, yeah, so that's it's still a business model which banks are working to crack.
Some countries like Ghana, for example, have in fact made efforts to formalize the SUSU model and have required SUSU collectors to actually register and follow a set of guidelines.
So. Yes, absolutely.
Well, then with that, I do want to thank you both for a wonderful presentation.